Hi, I'm Steve Dace. So if you're looking for a summer worldview camp, this is the place to be. July 16th through the 20th, we're going to encourage your kids to become the next generation of cultural leaders. We've got pastors like Douglas Wilson, filmmakers, cultural critics and commentators like myself and Matt Walsh from The Daily Wire. Sign up at calledconference.ninja. Again, Moscow, Idaho, July 16th through the 20th, calledconference.ninja.
As we work through the book, The Case for Classical Christian Education, we come to a topic that is a challenging one that's right at the center of many discussions about modern contemporary education. And here's the problem. If we look at an educational the educational systems of 500 years ago or 700 years ago, one of the most obvious things about it is that this education was being delivered to a small minority of the population. Education was not universal. Education was not anything close to being universal. And so if a child seemed really promising, if the child of a peasant seemed really promising, a patron or a donor might arrange for him to get an education, to pay for his tuition, that sort of thing. Or if a family from peasant stock did well for themselves, they might arrange for their children to get an education, as happened, for example, with Martin Luther. Martin Luther came from peasant stock, but his father did well in the mining industry and was able to arrange for young Martin to go to school. Whatever the case, you're dealing with education that is being delivered to a small sliver of the population. And generally, that small sliver would be above average in ability. So you're educating the children of aristocrats, you're educating nobility, you're educating the children of upper class people. With the birth of the modern era, as the modern era came online, we started confronting the challenge of universal education. What happens when you try to educate everybody? And there have been at least two distinct strains of thought. So, for example, the Puritan or the Reformed or the impetus behind the Protestant Reformation tended toward universal education because Protestants wanted universal literacy because they wanted everybody to have a Bible. John Knox was the one who was behind the formation of universal education in Scotland. William Tyndale, in his famous boast, said that before a few years passed, he would make sure that the plowboy, the boy that walks behind the plow, would know more about the scriptures than this ignorant cleric that he was talking to. So that was one impetus. The reformers wanted to provide universal education because they wanted universal access to the Bible. There was also another strain that it was more democratic in a small d democratic way, or more egalitarian, where universal education was seen as a right and not as a grace or not as a privilege. So when you're comparing education today to education 500 years ago, realize that it's lopsided. We have the challenge of educating everybody. And in the old days, they didn't have to educate everybody. They just had to educate the best and the brightest. So I'm overstating it slightly, but in the old days, every school was an honors program. Every school was an honors program. Today, that's not the case. Now, let me give one other illustration of this before I get into some of the things I say in Chapter 8 of The Case for Classical Christian Education, which is the chapter on democracy and egalitarianism. And that is, there are many critics of the public school system in America today, and the critics are usually on point. They have reasonable criticisms. They have reasonable things to say. But it needs to be noted that even today, with the educational system sort of in shambles, the top 10% of American kids in the government school systems, remain competitive with kids everywhere in the world. So our top 10% are still doing very well. They come from educated families. They come from families where literacy is valued, where work ethic is valued. And the top 10% are bright enough to do well. All you have to do is have them somewhere in the proximity of books, and they start picking things up. These are the kids who can teach themselves phonics off of a cereal box in the morning. So they figure out how to navigate their way. The top 10% need to have access to information, but they're not as dependent upon good teaching as the lower 90%. The lower 90% are the people who need a teacher, where prerequisites are required. They need to have someone walk them through the material. So if a school system fails, it won't fail everybody. If a school system fails, it will fail the people who need a teacher the most. So with that said, let me just read a few things out of this chapter and make comments as I go. Every culture has blasphemy laws. They are not always called that, but no society allows citizens to rail against the reigning deity. In our pluralistic times, these blasphemy laws are called hate crimes legislation, among other euphemisms. But they are really religious protections to keep the reigning god, Demos, from being blasphemed. So Demos is the Greek word for the people. Democracy is the rule of the people. It is quite possible for someone to go down into the main square of their city and stand on a park bench and blaspheme Zeus, or blaspheme Marduk, or blaspheme any of the gods that the people don't believe in. But you can't blaspheme in no society is it possible to blaspheme the reigning deity. The reigning deity currently is the people. The reigning deity is humanity. The reigning deity is the god that cannot be blasphemed any more than any other reigning god can be blasphemed. So I can pretty much guarantee that I could go downtown into any major American city and get myself arrested within 10 minutes on the simple basis of what I was saying. So we have laws that protect the reigning deity just like every other society does. So we are radically democratic. I'm not talking about the political party, capital D, democratic, but I'm talking about democratic with a small d. Here's something else I say in this chapter. In Christian cultures, envy is understood to be one of the seven deadly sins, what Shakespeare identified as a universal wolf. But in democratic societies, envy is institutionalized, and the tenets of such envy are diligently taught to the democratic young when they rise up, when they lie down, or when they walk along the road. The envy is not called that, of course, but rather goes by names such as fairness, justice, or equality. The Bible calls it envy. We call it justice, and that shows you the truth of what Isaiah said in Isaiah 5:20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute light for darkness, darkness for light. So, for example, here's another statement I make in this chapter. For example, we've gotten to the point where a preacher can spend the entire sermon talking about himself and his own struggles, and everyone says that he's being open, honest, transparent, and humble. Another man who proclaims the truth in a way that indicates something would have been true had he never been born is dismissed as an arrogant man. Our categories have gotten inverted, and this is due to the democratic enforcement of the leveling power of envy. So if a preacher stands up and says something like, "Thus saith the Lord," this is what God Almighty says, and this is what he would have said had I not shown up, had I not never been born, had I never gone to seminary, had I remained an unbeliever and never came to believe any of this stuff is still true. That man who dismisses himself as irrelevant is dismissed as arrogant. The person who talks about his own struggles, his own emotions, his own feelings for a straight 45 minutes is called humble. Now, in our school, we want to counteract this tendency. We don't want to go along with it. There are classical Christian schools, as I say, that do cultivate a snobbish, elitist environment. Far from teaching children to learn the nature of the world and how to occupy an appropriate station in it, they are what my daughter Rachel helpfully called classical schools for show poodles. These schools make it easy for critics who oppose a truly superior Christian education, which necessarily includes the inculcation of humility, to dismiss Christian schools as just more prep school snobbery. We don't want prep school snobbery. We want true humility. But true humility receives what God has to say and receives it from the hand of God. And when God, one of the things that God has to say is that the world is not a level plain. The world has mountain ranges in it. The world has valleys in it. Not everyone in the world is equally smart. Not everybody's going to get the same grades. Not every person is equally handsome or equally beautiful. But egalitarianism wants to insist that they must be. They want somehow everything to level out. Now, if you have a classroom of kids and you teach a hard lesson, a difficult lesson to learn, and 5% of the students master it and excel, and 5% of them flunk, and, you know, basically what it boils down to is the bell curve follows you everywhere you go. If you give a test and 100% of your students ace it, then that means it was a poorly composed test. That's also true if 100% of your students flunk it. If everybody flunks, it's a bad test. If everybody succeeds, it's a bad test. But if you give a test and you've got a handful who master it, another bigger handful does pretty good, the great majority does okay, and then a handful flunk, the bell curve is descriptive of the way God made the world. Now, as we're talking about civil rights, democracy, civil rights, egalitarianism, and envy, I address this. There's a vast difference between the way Christians and humanists define civil rights. For a Christian, rights tend to be negatively defined. For a humanist, they are positively stated. For example, a Christian approach can be seen in such common law rights as the right to trial by jury or habeas corpus. A humanist tends to define rights in terms of affordable housing or a living wage. But notice the sleight of hand. The right of one person to a living wage is a demand placed upon another person to pay it, and the assumed right of an intrusive government to enforce it. This means that a right to a free education for all translates to the demand that everyone be forced to pay through the nose for that free education. When Christians insist that habeas corpus should be honored in our civil law, they do not impose on anyone other than potential oppressors. So when I state rights negatively, basically if I say we have a right to free speech or we have the right to keep and bear arms, what that means is the government does not have the authority or the right to interfere with me when I buy a gun. All right, so leave that guy alone. That's how a sensible approach to rights would be. Every right has a corresponding obligation. So if Smith has a right to free chocolate milk, then Jones has an obligation to buy Smith his chocolate milk. If someone has a right to affordable housing, that means somebody else has the obligation to provide him with affordable housing. If someone has the right to $15 an hour, then that means that an employer has the obligation to pay him $15 an hour. But if someone has the right to free speech, what corresponding obligations are created? Well, I have the obligation to leave him, let him say his piece. Leave him, if he says something I disagree with, let him alone. If he has the right to keep and bear arms, what obligation does that create in me? Leave him alone. What obligation does it create in the government? Leave him alone. All right, so one of the things that a classical Christian school has to be is at war with the idea that education is a one-size-fits-all operation. It just simply is not. Classical Christian education is education for future leaders. And you can't have what is called the Lake Wobegon effect from Garrison Keillor, Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average. There's no such thing as a place where everybody is above average. So classical Christian education is anti-egalitarian. It's non-egalitarian. C.S. Lewis, echoing Aristotle, made a distinction when it comes to democratic education, when it comes to democracy and democratic education. When we refer to democratic education, are we referring to the kind of education that will preserve democracies, or are we referring to the kind of education that democracies like? Okay. The kind of education that democracies like is the kind of education that will destroy democracy. The kind of education that will preserve democracy is an education that rejects egalitarianism, that rejects this leveling impulse, that rejects all the motions of envy, and which is not ashamed to strive to provide an elite education for the kids.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.